So I just wanted to say, first of all, thanks so much for coming out. It's great to see you. I'm really excited about hearing what you all have to say, and I'm excited about tonight and all of what's going to happen tomorrow and participating in some hopefully big conversations together. I want to specifically thank the organizers of this festival, the Radical Imagination Festival, and Alex Kaznowich in particular. I gather that many more people have actually put lots of work into making this happen too, but sadly, I don't know all of them. So I will just say thank you. I also wanted to acknowledge that this event is happening on traditional Mi'kmaq territory. And I actually think it's important to say that not just as a formality, but actually in order to think about the context in which we struggle, in which we talk, as always in this situation, a colonial context, and also a context where there is amazing history and present day activity of indigenous resistance and resilience. And I take a great deal of inspiration from that and think deeply about my own responsibilities as a settler in relation to that. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska originally, which is traditional Dena'ina territory, and I currently live in Ottawa, Ontario on Algonquin territory. I lived on the US West Coast for a good number of years where I was involved in many different kinds of social justice struggles. And I actually spent 5 years in Sudbury, Ontario, a totally fascinating and challenging place on a Tigmishin Anishinaabeg territory where I learned a lot about what it means to struggle in very challenging circumstances. What I'm going to say tonight comes largely out of a research project that I've been working on for the last almost 8 years that involved me traveling around the North American context and interviewing radical organizers and activists to ask about lessons, challenges, and questions, and try and distill some of that out in a way that could be useful for other people. And finally, that came together in this book that I'm really excited to share with all of you, which is Another Politics, Talking Across Today's Transformative Movements. The one thing I have to say, whenever I actually say anything that's based on any of that, is that what I'm going to share with you does not come out of, it may look like it's coming out of my head and my mouth, but it's actually a collective set of lessons and a collective kind of knowledge that I'm trying to give some voice to. It's not about me being some kind of brilliant person. It's actually about the brilliance of our movements and our communities and struggle together. So even as you see my mouth move, try and envision the hundreds and hundreds of other people who are actually contributing together to creating this collective knowledge, if you can. And the last thing I just want to say is that because of time constraints, tonight I'm going to deliberately talk in short and kind of provocative ways, and hopefully that can open up into the bigger conversation following all of our comments. Make sense? Okay. So I was asked to talk about what movements inspire me and what are some lessons that I draw out of my involvement with them. There's lots of movements that inspire me. I'm kind of seen as almost a pathologically hopeful person. And that's partly because of my experience in social movements and my experience in struggle. And I always see possibilities within that. So lately, I've been drawing a lot of inspiration from migrant justice organizing across the Canadian context. In particular, No One Is Illegal collectives in a bunch of different cities. I'm also really excited about prison abolitionist organizing, especially connected to Critical Resistance, which is in the United States, an important organization. I draw a lot from anti-racist feminism, and especially the organization Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. And Idle No More and some really of the more recent kinds of upsurges in indigenous activity have really animated me and made me think about new kinds of questions in terms of asserting sovereignty and fighting colonialism. I also have some direct experience in anti-poverty organizing in Ontario and have been very close to the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. And I also draw a lot from radical queer and trans activism, especially organizations like the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York City. And not to bore you too much, but I do also think that there's some wonderful stuff happening right now in the more militant wing of the labor movement, especially in the public sector, where I think we're starting to see an uptick and some very interesting kinds of organizing that goes outside of normal channels. And of course, the Quebec student movement, right? I think posed a lot of interesting challenges and questions for us. So there's a lot that I draw from all those movements. I'm certainly not gonna try and go into all of it tonight, but I did wanna talk about three lessons that I think are especially important. They've at least struck me as important, and hopefully they'll resonate with you or be useful to you in some way. The first of these lessons is that how we treat one another really matters in movements. And I think one thing that many of us know from living in this society that we currently live in is how to relate to people in really terrible ways, with contempt, rivalry, objectification, and exclusion. You know, I think, in fact, that living in the society trains us how to treat other people like shit a lot of the time. And I think at their high points, social movements offer possibilities for people to actually relate with each other in better ways, right? To figure out more caring and equitable ways of treating one another. And in this way, I think movements create situations where we can maybe partially manifest a different kind of relational vision, right? That's based on respect, generosity, collaboration, and openness. But much of the time, and I'm sad to say this, I think that in activist groups and movements more generally, we don't actually treat each other all that much better than what happens in the rest of society, right? There's still a lot of ways that we end up treating each other like shit. And I don't think there's any way to quickly transform that reality. I think it's a real thing, and we have to relate to it. And those ways, those objectifying and dehumanizing ways of treating one another are deeply, deeply rooted in how this society is structured. And I don't think it's a surprise that they end up manifesting in all the different ways that we try and resist and struggle. But still, I think we have a responsibility to reach toward other ways of being and acting, other ways of treating one another. And as Montreal anti-prison organizer Helen Hudson once said to me, struggle can be a really humanizing experience. I think when people come together to fight collectively, we can experience our own humanity and the humanity of other people in deeply transformative ways. I think that's profound. And I believe that we can and should build movements that are compelling in part because they enable people to manifest their best selves. And we are able to see each other's best selves. So that's the first lesson. Second lesson is about taking an experimental approach. I think we always need to take an experimental approach in all the kinds of work that we're doing. And I think that treating any particular kind of tactic or practice, I mean, here we can think of many examples, consensus decision making, certain kinds of direct action tactics, specific kinds of organizations, treating any of those things as eternally correct, as things that we should always use no matter what, it's a dead end, right? The idea is to be more dynamic and to take an experimental approach where we try things and then we think about them, we evaluate them, and we try something else based on what we learned. So this always kind of ever-changing process, dynamic process of trying to learn from what we're doing. And here I think we can take a formulation that became more popular within the context of what was called the anti-globalization movement or the global justice movement, where people talked about movements or communities in struggle as laboratories of resistance. Laboratories of resistance. And David Solnit, who was an important organizer in much of that activity in the late 90s and the early 2000s, he one time wrote, "When we shift our thinking to see our organizing and action as a laboratory, then we can see our actions as experiments. In keeping with this spirit, much of the value of the experiment is in the evaluation and discussion of what we learned." So at the heart of this kind of experimental approach, I think there's a sequence. And the sequence is basically we try out stuff, we succeed, we fail. Oftentimes we both succeed and fail a little bit. We think about it, we try to learn from the successes and failures, evaluate, and then we try again, right? That's an experiment. And that's the kind of approach that I think we can use to move away from just trying to repeat the same stuff over and over again, but instead try and learn and try and be dynamic and relate to the world as it is, which is a constantly shifting place. Okay, so the last lesson that I want to highlight is the more abstract of what I'm going to say tonight. And that's that I think we have to link up the kind of against in what we're doing in our struggles and the beyond in what we're doing in our struggles. Let me try and explain by what I mean by against and beyond. These are terms, by the way, that I take from the radical theorist John Holloway. So in a broad sense, the against is our fight against ruling institutions and relations. It's our pushback. It's our defensive struggles of all sorts. The beyond is actually our creation of new ways of being, new ways of doing, new ways of organizing ourselves. It's when we try to put forward alternatives that are more liberatory in some way. And in some cases, those aren't entirely new. They're actually about recovering liberatory alternatives that pre-existed this current moment, right? This current dominant moment. But in any case, there's the against, that's the push, that's saying no, and there's the beyond, which is the yes, right? It's the affirming and creating new possibilities and new alternatives. And I think in our movements, often against and beyond are seen as separate or as in tension with one another. We tend to focus on one thing or the other, either fighting or building alternatives. And I think they have to go together. They always have to be together. We always have to be thinking about how they go together. So for one thing, if we're just focused on the against, without any kind of beyond, without any posing any kind of alternative, we don't have any resilience, right? Our movements can be as fierce and full of resistance as we can possibly make them. But if we actually want to create a more egalitarian and deeply democratic society, then struggle is actually not enough. We have to build new kinds of relationships, new kinds of organizations and institutions that can carry our alternatives as we try and displace the existing system. On the other hand, the beyond, right, the constructing of alternatives without the against is really easily isolated and co-opted. So the interlocking systems that rule our lives have an astounding capacity to accommodate and in some cases profit from rebellious countercultures, various kinds of alternative communities, when those aren't connected to transformative movements that are in some way trying to threaten how power and profit making happen in the society. So as the Team Colors Collective writes, this is a really interesting crew of activists in the United States, they say the seed of the new society is not just created in the shell of the old, but seeks to organize toward the point of confrontation, right? So it's about creating the seed of the new society, but it's also about moving to the point of confrontation where we push out the systems that dominate our lives. And I believe that if we consciously link together against and beyond in our organizing, we create possibilities for collective action that fundamentally challenges what is, like what currently exists, while practically building what we want to create. I think it's key. Okay, so the last part of what I'm going to say is I want to talk about some challenges. And it's hard to talk about challenges, particularly because it brings up challenging stuff, right? It brings up some of the negative stuff. And so I want to try to do this in a way that points toward some possible solutions to these challenges, because I think it's easy to just be down on stuff, but I want to actually think about it in a more constructive kind of way. And I want to start by just saying that I think that the biggest challenge to social and ecological justice on the planet right now is the set of interlocking systems of domination. And I'm talking about colonialism, capitalism, racism, heteropatriarchy, and ableism as a set of dominant systems that actually structure so much of what is happening right now. That's the major challenge that we face, right? Everything else to me is secondary. That's the major challenge. And these systems, I think, are generating misery and destruction in lives and ecosystems on a scale that has never been seen in history before. Like, the historical moment we're in is a moment of vast destruction and violence. And I think that these systems serve to basically enrich a very small group of people and keep the rest of us very demobilized and disempowered. That's basically how I see this picture. And I think our challenge is to dismantle and displace those systems. Now, in addition to that quite huge challenge, I think that there are some other kinds of challenges that we face within our movements and the ways that we struggle. And here again, I want to talk about three that have seemed important to me. The first of these challenges within our organizing is the tendency for movement spaces, usually unconsciously but not always, to replicate oppressive values and structures, right? To take the kinds of models that are happening in the dominant society and reproduce them in our movement spaces. So even as we fight social hierarchies based on gender, ability, race, class, and other systems, these hierarchies shape us, and frequently they shape how we participate in the struggles that we're participating in, right? So we can see examples of this in the types of people who feel confident about stepping up into various kinds of leadership positions. They often tend to look a lot like me. We can see this in the ways that activist groups tend to welcome and exclude certain kinds of people. We can think about this in terms of the kinds of exclusionary assumptions that often get built in to activist campaigns. We can actually go on. There's like so many kinds of examples. We can talk about how oppressive values and structures get taken up. And I think we can also see how this happens when we think about the sort of hyper-individualism, the competitiveness that even comes out in some of our most intentionally liberatory and egalitarian spaces, where people are still often thinking in terms of me first, right? Or how can I get ahead here? How can I put myself forward? How can I get some advantage from this? And so the way I think about this is with words from a prison abolitionist organizer in New York, Pilar Mashi. She said, "We're trying to break down the system, and it lies in all of us." Right? It's not just out there. It's actually about how we're participating in reproducing it. And I think the challenge is to deal with these kinds of power relations as they manifest, even as they infiltrate our most intentionally liberatory spaces. And I think a key part of that challenge is that none of us are untouched by these power relations, and there's no perfection or purity to be found, right? It's always about making imperfect choices and dealing with impure circumstances. But I think that doesn't mean we can't keep pushing toward a vision of collective liberation, even as we acknowledge the ways that we're implicated in all of this. And I actually believe that building large-scale transformative movements requires patience, humility, and a determination to struggle with this challenge without any easy answers or any quick resolution. So that's where I think about the long haul, right? We gotta be in this for the long haul, because we're not gonna fix it like that. Okay, so second challenge. I'm just gonna mention two more challenges, then I'm gonna wrap up here. So the second challenge is, I think there's a widespread habit of crisis mode organizing in so many of our communities in struggle. So how many people here have had an experience of organizing in response to an emergency situation, like a war, like someone being evicted from a house, like a new repressive law going into effect, like some kind of new resource extraction project happening? How many people have been in one of these kinds of emergency organizing situations? Okay, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Me too, I've been in a lot of those. So this is a kind of situation where you throw yourself into a short period of really frantic activity, leading up often to a big event or action, right? And then you're totally worn out. Is this resonating? Okay. So I think about this as the burn bright, burn out cycle of activism. And I think there's a lot of good reasons for this cycle, this kind of crisis mode cycle, because there are real crises happening all the time around us, right? The way that the society is currently structured actually produces security and stability for a tiny group of very wealthy and powerful people, and it requires massive insecurity and instability for the vast majority of the rest of us. Right? So there's no surprise at all that we experience a lot of crisis and we try to respond to it. And I think sometimes we can't respond in the most thoughtful and strategic ways. We just have to do what we can. The problem comes in here, I think, when we get so absorbed in a kind of crisis mode organizing that we're constantly postponing any kind of longer term visioning, any kind of longer term strategizing about what we're doing. We're just doing one thing after the other, and we're getting more and more worn out as we go. And I think if we don't make time for any kind of strategic planning and building a vision, and by this I mean putting our day-to-day fights into a broader, more conscious framework, we can easily end up just going through the cycle over and over and over again. Mary Foster, who's a really dedicated migrant justice organizer in Montreal, calls this running on a treadmill. She talked about how she often feels like her work is running on a treadmill of one crisis after another. And I think that's a very useful way to think about it. And I think the thing about running on a treadmill is that you can get really strong running on a treadmill. But I think the point is to dismantle the treadmill, right? Like, I don't want to be running on a treadmill forever. I actually want to, like, destroy that treadmill. And all the systems, right, that keep us racing along like that. And I think in order to do that, we have to think about what we're doing longer term and not just get stuck in this crisis mode all the time. Okay, the last challenge. I just wrote activist scenes. Activist scenes, I think, are a challenge. And when I say activist scenes, I mean the connected networks of communities, groups, and publications through which activists circulate in North America, right? And in most cities, there's a crew, right? There's a little community or a scene or a crew of radical activists. And I think that these scenes can provide some important support and resources for us, but they can also create a lot of problems. On the one hand, I think activist scenes can be spaces through which we become really comfortable with being marginal. And what I mean by this is that we can come to see ourselves as perpetual critics of everything, who rarely appeal to anyone else outside of our crew of friends, right? That's a kind of self-marginalizing way that activist scenes happen. I think on the other hand, activist scenes can drift into a sort of inflated self-importance, and that's because our communities are so small and relatively inconsequential. We are linked up across the continent in a lot of ways. We're very connected up with each other. And in this way, we can actually become, we can develop a really exaggerated sense of our significance and of the weight of our ideas. We can, because we are so closely connected to this, these tiny little crews all over, we can feel like what we're doing is important because 100 people liked it on Facebook. But it actually doesn't have much importance outside of that circle. And in this way, we can start to feel like the possibility for social transformation hinges on us in some small way, or some large way, that it hinges on us, even while we're actually really disconnected from most of the rest of society. And Tatiana Gomez, another migrant justice organizer in Montreal, said to me really bluntly at one point when I was interviewing her, "I don't think we're going to build a movement with about 100 anarchists in every major city." And I agree with her. Like, it's kind of a controversial thing to say, actually, because we're supposed to be like, that's great. We've got like 100 dedicated radicals in every major city, and they're going to bring the revolution. No, not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And I think the challenge here is to move beyond Jonathan Matthew Smucker, who's an activist writer based in Berkeley, he calls it the story of the righteous few. Right? This is a story that we often tell ourselves, that we're part of a very elite crew that has a monopoly on the truth. We know what's right. We're like the few and the proud, and we will always be the few and the proud. And that cuts us off from thinking about, well, how would we actually build? How would we actually be connected to other people who don't necessarily self-identify themselves as radical activists and share our values and our language and all that kind of stuff? I don't want to tell a story of the righteous few. I want to win. So just to say, by conclusion, in highlighting those three obstacles, I don't think I'm saying anything particularly new. I think this is stuff that lots of people have said before. I don't claim any kind of proprietary rights over this stuff. But I do strongly believe that we've got to grapple with some of these kinds of challenges, and I think there's a bunch of other challenges too. And otherwise, I think they're just going to continue to undermine our efforts. That's what I had to share with you this evening. Thank you.